Hello, I'm Bruce Celery. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. How much does it really cost to send your child to post-secondary education? Jeez, it is expensive, that I know. My kid's only 11, but I'm preparing for the worst here. Sometimes paying for your child's tuition might feel like paying for a second mortgage if you haven't saved. And even if you have, it can be a lot. Making that big a financial decision is very, very tough. Ron Lieber is the Your Money columnist for the New York Times, and he explores this whole big, complicated question in his latest book. It's called The Price You Pay for College. Then, learning doesn't have to stop right after school. Yeah, no, we're all supposed to be continually learning. So we're going to talk about a skills hub with a financial literacy component. It was created by ABC Life Literacy Canada. Its executive director, Mac Rogers, will be here to talk about that. And a fascinating discussion about funerals and memorial services in this time. There is a new company called Afterword that is doing a whole virtual thing with these kinds of events. Effie Anolik will be our guest to talk about how she's customizing these virtual funerals and memorial services. Then a new book called When Anything is Possible. Its author is David Wells. He's going to talk about strategic living and in particular, the ways that wealthy families can utilize their wealth, sometimes quite significant wealth, to improve the state of the world. Plus our blogger spotlight with Rob Engen from Boomer and Echo. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. Let's get started. Sending your kid or kids to college or university is really, really expensive. It is tuition and books and travel and residence and maybe a little bit of beer money. But the idea is that these costs are offset by the benefits, the joy of learning, perhaps, but certainly the hope that a post-secondary education will earn its recipient more money over time. That's a part of the calculation. Ron Lieber is the Your Money columnist for the New York Times, and he has written a new book called The Price You Pay for College. He joins us now from Brooklyn, New York. Hello there.
Hello.
We spoke a while ago about your prior book called The Opposite of Spoiled. We're continuing on the kid theme here. This one talking about education. Why this issue?
Well, people kept showing up, essentially crying in my inbox at the New York Times each spring because they had not really woken up to how much this would cost. They had thought that there would be bigger discounts available for them. And then when they didn't get what they expect, they realized that they had not really studied up on the system and how it had changed. And they realized that it was probably too late and they were begging for help. Yeah.
Right. So the help arrives in the form of a couple hundred pages. Now, Canada and the US are different. The schools are less expensive here. The way we save for it is a bit different, but there's so much the same. You talk about the three main purposes of learning, kinship, and then the, you know, financial opportunity at the end of it all. What has changed in that algorithm since the pandemic arrived?
Well, when everybody gets sent home from their residential undergraduate experience, you lose two of those three things in no small part, right? The learning, it's just fundamentally different. And nobody would argue that it's anywhere close to as meaningful. And in fact, college presidents have been in the New York Times and elsewhere sort of bemoaning how much has been lost. Obviously, the same thing's true with the kinship. You can't spend time with your friends or can't do it in the same way that you used to, and ditto the time that you might have spent bonding with mentors, with professors or administrators or other adults who can have an outsized impact on you and your development. And so when that all goes away, all you're left with is the credential. And then all of a sudden, you're paying the same amount of money for a thing that is nowhere close to what it once was. Yeah.
The subtitle of this book is A New Roadmap for the Biggest Decision Your Family Will Ever Make. I only have an 11-year-old, so I guess maybe it's too early in the cycle here, but I don't really think of it as a decision. Do you mean if to go or where to go?
Well, I think it's both. I mean, there are an increasing number of people who question the value of it altogether. And it's much easier to do that when you've got an 11 or 12 year old and you're just sort of spitballing than it is with a 17 or 18 year old. And maybe all of their peers or most of them are thinking about going to university. But, you know, there are real questions, you know, around is there going to be a shortage of skilled tradespeople? And shouldn't we be paying more attention to channeling more people towards that? So, you know, there is the if question, and then there's the where question. There is the when, if ever, is it worth it to pay a whole lot more than whatever the lowest cost option might be? And how do you figure that out? So one of the things I'm trying to do is just develop a list of framing topics and a set of pointed questions for each one that help people begin to determine for themselves where the value might lie and what might be worth paying extra for.
You say part of your purpose is, I hope this book makes you more emotionally honest with yourself. And I love that because I think most of us think, no, I'm good. I'm good. I am very logical. I am empirical. I am data-driven about this. You would argue otherwise.
Well, I mean, who among us makes cool-headed decisions about our children 100% of the time, let alone when five or six-figure amounts of money are involved, and we're dealing with systems and an entire industry that, you know, we may not be familiar with, but we may think we are super familiar with because we did it all 30 years ago or something, right? So we think we're experts, but we're not, right? So emotions like fear and guilt and, you know, snobbery and elitism certainly come into play. And so, you know, I try to walk people through all of those and just to be, you know, much more emotionally honest with themselves about what they're experiencing in their own heads, and then emotionally intelligent about how they navigate the process.
You talk about a number of things that you argue are worth paying for: small class sizes, higher probability of mentoring. You also talk about mental health care. How do you assess the quality of that? Because I think you'll get universal agreement that it's critical. It's so important at that age, at that time in life in particular. How broad a spectrum is there in terms of what different colleges and universities offer?
Well, as a shopper for undergraduate educations, you can't really do a qualitative assessment of the quality of any particular collection of mental health practitioners, but you can ask questions about the system, right? Mm-hmm. Because there is more demand than there is supply on just about every undergraduate campus right now. These schools did not get into business to be, mental health care providers, but they're sort of doing it because they have to, right? So how long do you have to wait for your first appointment? Does the mental health counseling center cap the number of times you can see someone one-on-one? What is the actual ratio of full-time counselors, and not just grad students in training, full-time counselors to undergraduates? You can do a search of the college newspaper and look for articles that have been written, because there are more than a few controversies on undergraduate campuses about both the quantity and the quality of mental health care on these campuses.
Are those data points available at major campuses? I mean, I think those are all good questions. I just have no idea how I, as a parent, would get that information.
No. They're not broadcasting this stuff, on their websites, but every single institution tracks this stuff because they report it to, you know, centralized industry associations, and those industry associations publish the data. So you can be sure that every college is tracking this in some way, shape, or form. They may not be proud of this data, but, you know, part of what I'm trying to do here is raise an army of better informed consumers to ask more pointed questions about things of underestimated importance, right?
And if a thousand parents ask the question, then an institution's going to put it in an annual report because they're like, oh my God, they all want to know about this. I may as well tell them.
Exactly, right? And, you know, I want people to feel a little more entitled to this information. If, you know, the cost is going to be, you know, $100,000, $200,000, $300,000, don't we deserve a little bit more from these places? I think we do.
I would agree on that front. You also say that diversity is worth paying for. And this, it's almost paradoxical because the examples that you give are, I think, from your experience about all that you learned from high income, low income, visible minorities, all that stuff. And at the same time, the brand equity of the most elite institutions in America, and to a lesser extent, Canada, is this world of privilege, its uniformity, its Wall Street, or the best launching pad for the grad school of your dreams. How does that paradox get reconciled?
It's interesting that you see it that way. My sense is that the most selective institutions in the United States would blanch if that is what they knew that you thought of them, because they very much want to stand for something different. That is what they came to stand for, in the 1980s and the 1990s, as they became more selective, but had not yet, turned on to the benefits of a more diverse undergraduate pool of students, right? I think they would take issue with that. But where those two things meet is that the challenge with trying to create a diverse environment is, do you end up with an environment where every opinion is actually respected? Or do you end up in a situation where people are relatively atomized and all of the groups that are there don't actually interact as much as you might hope as an educator or an administrator? So, the question I always encourage people to ask is, what opinions around this joint are not welcome, right? What was the last big argument that took place? And who did not feel like their voice was being heard? Better start there and you see where it goes.
At stereotypically, maybe stereotypical is the wrong word, but at left-leaning colleges, you can imagine that those who have a libertarian view might have a harder time getting a seat at the table.
I think that's probably the case. And so these are why you ask these questions.
Yeah. Diversity is such an interesting question here in Canada, because you really only find that at the major universities in the major cities, right? The smaller colleges, people will have to pay a significant amount of money to afford the residence to move to the smaller town to do that. And that takes out, that then it carves up the market in a way that accounts for economic situation to the detriment of diversity.
Yeah, we have similar issues here in the United States. I mean, the president of St. Olaf College in Northfield, Minnesota, said to me, student shoppers want to learn in diverse environments. And if we can't provide that for them, then we're going to have a problem. But if you're in Minnesota and it's cold and you're an hour from the Twin Cities and there's not a lot of diversity around you in the town or nearby, you're sort of in a pickle, right? Because, how do you become more diverse if you can't provide diversity for the diverse populations that don't want to have to do the work of representing other people like them in a small group in front of a large group of white people, right? It's a difficult thing to change on a dime.
You also say career services matter. What's the gold standard? What does the gold standard look like?
Yeah, so that's an excellent question, because so many universities in the United States right now are literally blowing their buildings to smithereens and starting over and trying to build something better. I think the question you have to ask yourself is, what is in it for the student who has no idea what they want to do? What sort of counseling does that career center provide? Is there a four-year roadmap that begins with the first year and helping people find themselves? Is there a thriving internship program where an internship is guaranteed? As a prospective student, can you ask for the first destination survey such that you can find out, of all 18 religion majors or all 12 Spanish majors. What happened to them a year after they graduated? Where did they go? What did they earn? If the school doesn't have this data, then it's probably not paying enough attention to what is happening to people after they leave. And so that's a pretty good test.
You devote a whole chapter to the College of Worcester. Am I pronouncing that right? Worcester? Never heard of it. It's centered around its independent study approach. How do they do it? And why do you believe that is such a powerful way to do it?
So I spent a lot of time in my reporting trying to find the schools in the United States where the parents' ability to pay was beginning to clash with their willingness to do so. So a whole bunch of relatively selective institutions that still had to fight pretty hard in the marketplace for students, such that they have to pay a whole bunch of these, you know, academic merit aid awards to get people to come. And then among those universities and colleges, I tried to find any that were just standing out, that were distinctive. You know, there isn't really that much innovation in undergraduate education here in the United States. It looks a lot like it did a generation ago. So there's some research from Gallup that showed that people who had a mentor and who worked on a long-term project while they were undergraduates tended to be much more satisfied as a result of the experience. And so when I found out that Worcester had, you know, what's essentially a mandatory undergraduate thesis, that sort of struck out for me, right? Stuck out because it's a, you know, there's mentorship going on, it's a long-term project, and it's a way to get students engaged in the very things that Gallup thought was interesting. And so, you know, I went and visited there in April. Every single person who does one of these independent studies has to present in some way, shape, or form on a Friday in April. And it's like some kind of Woodstock, you know, except at a university. It just the most amazing stuff is on the walls and on the screens. And, you know, I could have spent days doing this. And I thought, this is the kind of thing that, you know, that I want my kid to experience. So I didn't mean to endorse Worcester per se. Yeah. It's just that we all need to be looking for schools that are doing something distinctive and have a way of talking about it that feels like it'll be meaningful to our families and to our kids in particular.
I read all those examples and I reflected back on my own undergraduate experience and I was left with one very important question. Do kids not go to keggers anymore? Like when is the binge drinking? When's the, all the stuff of the movies and certainly that reflected my experience, they seem so grown up and focused and I don't know, boring.
You know, I probably did not spend enough time at keg parties while I was reporting The Price You Pay for College.
But they still happen.
They still happen. People are drinking and you know, there's now all this legal marijuana all over the United States too. So, you know, you could argue that the mind-altering substances that they're ingesting are, you know, maybe a little bit better for them, or they're at least a little more mellow.
Maybe it's helping. Ron, great work on the book, and thank you for joining us to talk to us about it.
It is my pleasure.
Ron Lieber is the Your Money columnist for the New York Times. His new book is called The Price You Pay for College. Thankfully, I'm saving for Abby's education, but clearly there is more research to be done.
You're listening to Moolah Law, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
COVID-19 has changed so many things. And for grieving families in this time, it has also changed the traditional way in which we have funerals and memorial services and all that stuff. Very, very difficult for families in those circumstances. And there are some workarounds. So traditional funeral homes are providing these services and some new entries, some startups are also providing services to fill this gap. One of them is a company called Afterword, and it has a service that helps clients plan a virtual experience for loved ones. Joining us now to talk about it is Effie Anolik. She is the founder of Afterword. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce.
What was the idea? Where did this idea come from?
This really started in 2018, or the idea for it started in 2018 when my dad passed away and I planned my first funeral. And I was immediately surprised by the process and ended up planning a traditional version of a service that really didn't represent what my dad meant to me.
So that obviously was a deeply personal experience. It then translated to the launch of this business.
That's right. Yeah, before COVID, we were focused on bringing funeral planning online, which I still truly believe is the future. And we were a business-to-business company catering towards funeral homes. And then, of course, since COVID, have since changed to work directly with families.
Effie, there are three offerings on your website. Can you tell us about those three things you offer?
Of course. So there are really two streams. The first is the live stream, and that's when there's an in-person service, whether that's at a funeral home or a place of worship. And how that works is we send a professional videographer on site, and we also connect into a screen within the service so that we can include guests who can't be there in person in the service so they can pray or do a eulogy, or we can play pre-recordings into the room as well as online. And the second stream is virtual only, which honestly isn't that different from a traditional service in the sense that you still have eulogies. If there's a faith piece, that's included. The unique part of that is that people can pre-record. We do quite a bit of visual editing as well, so we can add photos to eulogies. We do a lot of narration on top of slideshows to really give the storyline of someone's life and include a lot of visuals for that as well. And the main difference with that is that everybody is logging on from their homes. And we also have built software on top of Zoom to help us automate the process. So you put in the order of speakers and any multimedia, and essentially it's automated. And we've recently started offering that to families who are a bit more tech savvy that still want to be fully present and not worry about muting and not worry about spotlighting, but do it more on their own.
And the cost range for those services that you provide, at the low end, sort of $800, at the higher end for the live stream, closer to $1,500.
That's exactly right. And our prices are in USD. We work with families across Canada and the States. And then the self-service is $200. And we still meet with families to plan the service. We'll help them put in all of their media and put the order of speakers there. And then we hand it off to them for the actual service.
What has been the hardest part of this experience to capture? I mean, it obviously is a very, very intimate experience for the grieving family, for the friends of the deceased. What has been the hardest part to recreate?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I'd actually say that there are many benefits for being virtual that have become surprising that there's such a benefit. For example, a lot of families have told us that they really love that they can see everyone's face up close on screen, whereas in person, they're in the front row and their back is to everyone there. They can't really see who's there. And the one really unique part of virtual that's been really lovely is that we do something that we've been calling the sharing circle after the planned program, where we invite guests to unmute themselves and share a memory or story, which is really unique and awesome because in person, people tend to clump together with the people that they know. So work friends get to hear work stories, and people who grew up together get to hear those stories. And virtually everyone gets to hear all the different aspects of someone's life. So although it sounds like you might be missing out of the human touch and the interaction, we're really learning that you can feel supported virtually.
Mm. And you record it, right? That is a part of the legacy of the event.
That's right. We record it. We share that on an unlisted page, so it's easier to share with family or friends. We also give them a hard copy. And we also have a virtual guest book on all of the memorial pages where guests can leave a video message, a voice note, or write a memory there as well. So there are many different ways that they can rewatch the different stories that people have.
How do you work with the traditional funeral homes? Because I was talking to some associations earlier today on this topic, and they said that they live stream. They were doing it once a month prior to COVID. Now they're doing it all the time. Right. Maybe not with the level of sophistication that you offer, but for those who are already connected to a traditional funeral home, is your service an overlay, or is this one that you would do if you don't have that traditional funeral home service set up?
Yeah, we've partnered with many funeral homes to bring in an elevated experience. So the traditional funeral home right now is not, they don't have a camera operator. For example, they'll set up an iPad, which works great within a room that doesn't really follow the service. And then when you're playing different media on screens, they're filming the screen. We make it much more interactive, and we make sure that everyone who's in person sees the screen clearly. And then we also play the media online in a different format so that they're watching that more clearly. So we're definitely an additional service, and we'll come in and work with many funeral homes and again, bring in professional videographers to really make it feel like you're there.
And you said you do these kinds of events all over the place. How do you find camera operators in centers all over the place?
Yeah, it actually started in early lockdown, I suppose. We were doing virtual only services, and then I started getting requests within Toronto. So I just took my DSLR and would go to funeral homes or churches and figure out how to tap into their audio and make sure that that was professionally done. And then of course, that's quite limiting to just Toronto. So we started building a network of videographers around the States and around Canada. And at first it started with, we'd get a request and then we would find someone. And now, of course, we have a much larger, extensive list so that if someone calls us from somewhere within Texas, we can tap into people in our network to bring them to those services.
Wow. Really interesting stuff. Thank you so much, Effie, for joining us to talk about it.
Yeah. Thank you for having me.
Afterward is a really interesting way of having a virtual funeral or memorial service. Its founder, Effie Anolik, joined us to talk about that. Stay with us. Coming up next on Moolala, our blogger spotlight features Rob Engen from Boomer and Echo, and later Mac Rogers from ABC Life Literacy Canada on its financial literacy portal. For all things Moolala, you can sign up to our newsletter. It is super simple. Go to moolala.ca, sign up once a month. We never do anything with your email address. All that is great. Our website has lots of archives and info on personal finance topics. You just go to moolala.ca.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
It's time now for our blogger spotlight. This is a thing we do every show. Well, not every show, but most shows. We highlight some of the amazing personal finance websites out there, some Canadian, some international. Here we're headed to Lethbridge, Alberta. Our guest is Rob Engen. He is founder of Boomer and Echo. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce.
You're like a veteran. This goes back, what, 10 or 11 years or so, this blog? What has been your most read post of all time?
Oh, my goodness. I would say my readers tend to skew towards an older demographic, and I've written quite a few series or posts around Canada Pension Plan. And so whether to take it at 60 or 65 or 70. So those posts tend to do extremely well. Even year over year, was people are searching for that type of information.
I love that those posts do well. I got to say, that's one of the most boring sentences I have ever heard uttered on this program, though I'm sure you deliver it with charm and charisma, CPP timing. Woo! And what's the answer?
I wish I had something more exciting to talk about. Yeah, like, to say
really
my top
it's about
post was.
How to discover diamonds in a bagel. That's right. That's really what you should, that's clickbait. So What's the answer on CPP? Hold off till 70?
That tends to be the consensus on the research. The most recent research that has come out is at least trying to educate Canadians that you have the option of deferring it past age 65 and up to age 70, will get an increased or enhanced benefit for doing so. So that's
a pretty significant enhanced benefit, too.
It really is. I think some latest research came out suggesting something like a $100,000 lifetime income if you actually defer it. So it is significant.
So let's go back to the beginning. Where were you at in 2010 that had you say, I'm going to start a blog?
Oh, my goodness. Well, yeah, like you said, that 10 or 11 years of blogging, that makes me like a grandfather in blogging terms. You know, I just turned 30. We had our first baby, and I had just changed careers. So I moved from the hospitality industry into the public sector. And so much different. I was traveling less, really kind of a 9-to-5 gig. And then plus we had a newborn who thankfully was sleeping through the night, and just found myself with lots of downtime and just really wrestling with my own financial decisions, starting an RESP. I moved over to now contributing to a defined benefit pension plan. So really just discovering new things on my own. And I started reading blogs. I was reading, you know, Preet Banerjee's Where Does All My Money Go? And yeah. Million Dollar Journey. And as I poured through these archives, I started thinking, you know, I could start documenting my own journey. And here we are.
What have been some of the highs and lows of that journey for you? Or said another way, what has been easy? You're like, oh, I don't know, I can do that. And what has been a real slog on the blog?
Well, I love writing. And so that's been the real therapeutic part of it, is kind of I'm learning, I'm wrestling with my own decisions, and I'm talking about them. And so that, I think, would be the initial part of my journey, was me just kind of discovering my own path to financial freedom. But I am not a technical or web savvy person whatsoever. So the behind the scenes thing, I've broke my website before and had to call in favors to rescue it. And so more of the technical aspect of learning kind of behind the scenes, what goes into managing a blog, I would say is more challenging, whereas I prefer to write and promote and respond to my readers.
Investing is a part of it, obviously. You, I understand, reached $100,000 in assets by the time you turned 35, and then you had an epiphany. What did you discover?
So, you know, when I started investing, I had moved from my hospitality career where I was contributing to a group RSP, and they were in some really high fee mutual funds. And so, you know, I was reading a lot of Money Sense and Norm Rothery's Dividend All-Stars and things like that. And so I decided, you know, when I switched careers, I was going to move that money out and I was going to invest on my own in these dividend paying stocks. And they did really well. This was in 2009 and the markets were on fire, and my stock portfolio was going up and up in value. And I thought I was a genius. But it turns out, you know, the rising tide lifts all boats. And as I started reading more and diving into some of the more academic and empirical research around index investing, I decided that I wasn't as smart as I thought I was. And so I sold my $100,000 roughly portfolio of dividend stocks and moved into a global equity portfolio using Vanguard ETFs.
Right. Super boring, passive, and low fee.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. You're on track for Freedom 45. Is that accurate? Freedom 45, is that a new slogan for London Life or whichever insurance company it was made popular, Freedom 55?
Well, I started talking about that kind of, I would say maybe a little bit before this whole FIRE movement took hold. And so I wasn't really using that kind of language. But what I was really after, and I think what a lot of people who are chasing this FIRE, financial independence, retire early mantra, what I was looking for was some independence from, you know, the 9-to-5 cubicle life. And so I had started this side hustle, which was the blog, and I was doing some freelance writing. I even wrote for the Toronto Star for a number of years, and I was earning a decent amount of money on the side. And so, you know, the dream was always, could I get myself to a point where, you know, I've built up my investments and also built up these multiple income streams, these side hustle income streams, so that I could eventually leave my day job. And that's what I did in the end of 2019.
What has been the best part of that? And what has been the most challenging part of that for you?
Well, I don't recommend anyone quit their job of a decent salary and benefits 3 months before a global pandemic.
Okay, noted. Thank you. Helpful.
But the best part has certainly been the freedom of kind of working from home, setting my own hours, working on the projects that I want to work on rather than being stuck in the Monday weekly meeting. And so just that freedom, even though it's not what I had anticipated in terms of what I was really after, Bruce, was this kind of location independent lifestyle where we could go traveling when the kids are off school and I could, you know, use the laptop to write an article or, you know, interact with my clients. And, you know, that obviously hasn't happened because of the pandemic, but I can see that that could be a big part of this lifestyle down the road.
Yeah, it's interesting because for many people who haven't gone the freelancer side hustle route, they've got more independence in some ways because no one's tethered to the office anymore. Not no one, fewer people are tethered to the office now.
Yes, exactly. So a lot of people are discovering this as they work from home. And, I think a lot of light bulbs are going off.
Yeah, like, they still have to dial in for the Monday meeting, but they could be dialing in from Aruba or wherever else. I want to ask you one last question that I ask a lot on this program, and I think it's clarifying. And it is this: if you could snap your fingers and change one behavior in Canadian society at large when it comes to money, what would it be?
I think what would be topical right now is just this obsession with real estate. And I think that is really highlighted in the Toronto area or Vancouver area. And just understanding that it's okay to rent. Renting gives you options and freedom, especially in your younger years, but even in your retirement years. And so I think we're just really, really obsessed with owning a home. And I wish that people understood that there were other options out there that didn't tether them to being house poor for 25 years.
Yeah. Great stuff. Keep up the great work on your blog, Rob.
Thank you so much, Bruce. I appreciate it.
And thanks for joining us today. Rob Engen is the founder behind the blog Boomer and Echo. He joined us from Lethbridge, Alberta. Stay with us. Coming up later, Mac Rogers from ABC Life Literacy Canada will be here. He's going to tell us about the ABC Skills Hub, which has a focus on all things, including financial literacy. But first, David Wells, founder of Family Capital Strategy, will be here. He has a new book out called When Anything Is Possible, and it focuses on the huge opportunity for wealthy families to make a big difference in the world. If you want to hear more Moolala, you can head over to our website, moolala.ca. You can also go to any of the podcast platforms, right? You can listen to the podcast there. You can download it. You can write a review. You can even subscribe to the next episode.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
There are the haves and the have-nots, right? The have-nots in this pandemic are dealing with pressing financial needs, rent, food, safety. And then of the haves, they have a lot. And a lot of them, I will say, a lot of them are making a big effort to give generously and to give wisely to make the world a better place. And that's going to be the focus of this conversation. David Wells is the founder of Family Capital Strategy, and he's the author of a book called When Anything Is Possible, Wealth and the Art of Strategic Living. He joins us now from Nashville, Tennessee. Hello there.
Hey, how's it going, Bruce?
Great. I think what I love about this topic is it's a bit of a jog left in our conversation about personal finance and financial wellness. So much of it is focused on those who are having a really, really hard time. And this book is about those who are not having a hard time in that way. In fact, they have wealth in abundance. Tell us why you wanted to write this book.
Yeah, I love your intro because it seems so counterintuitive right now because there are people who are suffering so tremendously in this pandemic that just kind of keeps going on. And then the flip side is that there are people who are becoming or are wealthier than they ever imagined. And so my time in and around the investment space and then working with ultra high net worth, really wealthy families, I think folks who end up in those circumstances, it's kind of like the dog who catches the bus. It's not necessarily something that they planned on. It's something that happens to them. And as a result, there's just a whole bunch of questions that arise. And I think the natural reaction is almost like a fear-based response of like, I don't want to screw up the tremendous responsibility of this wealth. Yeah. But where do I go from here? And it can be so overwhelming. And so the book was like, how can I give people a framework to begin to digest this new reality that they find themselves in?
And I can imagine many of them are the recipients of a near endless stream of requests that if they don't immediately say yes to everything makes them feel bad or raises the ire of the askers, particularly if they're close. So you use this phrase, the art of strategic living. What does strategic living mean in your view?
Yeah. So in my mind, it's kind of goes back to like what Socrates said, which was that the unexamined life is not worth living. And so I think for people who have means and wealth, it's how do you begin to think strategically, which is how do I look out in the future, identify my priorities, and then make sure that the steps that I'm taking today are in alignment with what's most important to me. And it's beginning to be more thoughtful as opposed to either reactive to things, or I think most people with money just, you know, they don't even, it's just money comes in, money goes out. You know, you buy something on Amazon, you don't give it a whole lot of thought. So it's beginning to introduce a little bit more consciousness to the decisions that you're making so that it's aligned with what you think is most important in the world.
Speaking of Amazon, and I love that you focus on this example because it's so resonant for people, is Jeff Bezos's former wife, Mackenzie Scott, has a lot of money. Tell us about her approach.
Yeah, I think she's a fascinating case study of someone who I think has gotten this really right. And if you look at her philanthropic activity, and she's given away to the order on the order of like $6 to $7 billion in the last 9 months or so. And it's and giving money away is on that scale is really challenging. And what I think is really unique about her approach is she took, I think my guess is she has a real clear view of what she wants to accomplish. And then in a very short order period of time, because of, you know, the real nature of the crisis, she was able to identify and vet hundreds of organizations that met her criteria. And then she gave the gift of giving to operating budgets or to endowments, to things where it wasn't about a building with her name on it. It was, hey, this organization has a model for change, for bringing improvement in the world. What would it look like if somebody came in and really supercharged what they did?
How would you look at the steps of how one brings strategic living to life? Is there an A, a B, a C, and a D?
Yes, I think of it in three steps. So the first is kind of like you lay out the goal lines of the soccer pitch. It's the what is the structure of your wealth? So what is it that you actually own? And at the financial level, you know, that's your balance sheet. It's the, you know, the assets and liabilities. But I think you even need to expand that to think about what are the other pieces of wealth, you know, the relationships that you have, the human investment, your education, the skills that you've developed over the years, the things in society that you're passionate about. So it's getting a real landscape of, okay, this is all of my assets, financial and otherwise. So that's part one. Part two is a little squishier, and I term it wealth identity, but it really comes down to this question of, okay, what are the messages that I've received about wealth and its responsibility? How have I internalized those? And then how do I begin to think about my own mission statement, if you will, you know, vision statements, core values, the things that are most important to me, and how does who I am and what I want to accomplish in the world align with the messaging that I've received growing up? I think so many of us internalize things and we never actually articulate it because it's kind of like lenses we wear on our glasses. We just see the world this way, but we don't realize that maybe we're colorblind or something like that. Mm. Once you've got those two pieces of structure and identity, now you can really tee up this question of strategy. And the simple fact is there's really only four things you can do with your money. You can consume it, you know, you can invest it, you can give to future generations within your family, and then you can give to philanthropic causes. I mean, I guess there's a fifth thing that you can do with your money, which is pay taxes, but I generally have not found people to like voluntarily
sign up to
do more of
that. You're really excited about
that.
Yeah.
It's really those big four. And I think what's really interesting is, especially with consumption, I think that gets a lot of the lion's share time of attention is like, how much am I spending? And then how much am I investing? I think most people, once they know that their needs are provided for, then the mindset really shifts to, okay, what am I trying to do within my family? And are there ways to support future generations? And then what's the responsibility that I have to those around me, to the community that I grew up in, to the needs in the world, whether it's, you know, education, healthcare, climate change, the things that I think are really important. And how do I, you know, what can I do with my little piece of the world to make a difference with some of these problems that are out there?
It is easier to make a link to between our values and organizations. So you value education and you choose organizations. What seems to be much more difficult is how to assess the efficacy of the recipient in that values-driven sector, for example. Like, is what's one education charity versus another? They could have very, very different, a very, very different ability to affect change in the world. How do wealthy families ensure that their money is well spent in that regard?
I think it's a great question. And I think you see it falling out in a couple of ways. You know, for some families, it's, you know, they write a check and then they also roll up their sleeves. And so that may mean they're serving in the board, in the boardroom of the organization, they're volunteering. You know, there's a way to stay involved to kind of see how things are going. I think for some folks, that's a really natural pathway for things that they're passionate about. Honestly, I find a lot of families, they follow other families. And so, you know, if they take education, for example, if that's something that you're passionate about, but you don't have either the time or resources to really build like a team at your family foundation, they may find other families who they think are doing it well and kind of coattail ride and say, look, these folks are doing a great job. Like it's kind of what Warren Buffett did with Bill Gates. He looked at Bill Gates and said, look, Gates has got this thing figured out. Why don't I just supercharge him with another, you know, couple 20, 30, $40 billion
right,
and just like and allow him to do more of what good work he's already doing. So I think that's another, it's an easier way to do it. And then, you know, to some extent, you know, you take a risk, right? Like I think that's the challenge. If social problems were easy to solve, then we would have addressed them a long time ago. And so to some extent, it's, you know, you have to spread a lot of bets. You've got to look at a lot of different theories of change and then figure out and over time see, like, is the population set that this charity is addressing and the need that it's addressing, is it actually getting the work done? Or is there a better mousetrap that's come along? And I think what we've seen even in the last like number of years is that technology and other things are bringing attention to issues and are allowing new models to develop that are more effective than things that we've had in the past.
Really interesting stuff, David. Thank you for joining us today to talk about it.
Thanks, Bruce. It's my pleasure.
David Wells is the author of When Anything is Possible, a new take on what some of the wealthiest among us are doing to make the world a better place. Stay with us. Coming up next, Mac Rogers from ABC Life Literacy Canada is going to be here to talk about our new skills hub for adult learners, and in particular, the sort of financial literacy programs that they offer. I'm the money columnist for a TV show called CityLine. You can find all the segments that I have done on that platform at cityline.tv, cityline.tv. Search for my name. More importantly, though, they've got great content on all sorts of other things that are even more interesting, like food and fashion and decor and all that stuff.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Financial literacy is important for everyone, no matter how old or young you are. But in order to build on your personal finances, it's really important to know the basics of savings and understanding your bank account and all that stuff. ABC Life Literacy Canada has launched an online learning portal called the ABC Skills Hub, and they've got a bunch of courses that focus in particular on improving financial knowledge. Joining us now to talk more about it is Mac Rogers. He is Executive Director of ABC Life Literacy Canada. Hello there.
Hello, Bruce. How are you?
There's tons of stuff out there. Why did you decide that you would invest your time and your energy and your resources in order to bring more to the marketplace? Is it new? Is it different? Is it better?
It is. It is actually all of those things. So what we really wanted to focus on, particularly in light of the pandemic, is helping people think about money differently and having the confidence to start talking about money in the family, to start making better choices, and really kind of talking to professionals to get the help they need. 4 in 10 Canadians disclose that money is a daily concern, and that's a terrifying number. And I think a lot of us can relate to that.
Tell us a bit about the curriculum here. I've got it up on my screen. This is not puts and calls, short covering, peg ratios, stock analysis. This is really foundational material.
That's it exactly. It's really, if you were to look at our objectives, they're about building confidence and the confidence to start those conversations. So it does cover topics like spending plans and banking basics. What is a checking account? What is a saving account? Borrowing money and ways to save. So we do talk about things like what is a credit score and how do you find out what your credit score is? But really, it's about building that confidence so that when you have a problem, you can talk to the professionals or family members that you know and trust to help you out.
Who are you targeting? Who do you want to enroll in this stuff?
So we really want to enroll anyone who's thinking about money in a way that's challenging. But we write it in such a way that it's accessible to a lot of Canadians. We write it at a level that is very easy to decode and to access. And so that's really our core belief. So where this program gets used a lot is in learning centers and in newcomer centers and Indigenous learning centers. That's where our resources are used a lot. But now, thanks to the abcskillshub.ca and the support we're getting from TD Bank Group, we can really move it online and get everyone to use it.
It's free, right?
It's all free. Everything ABC does is free. We also have resources on our website. If you specifically want to look at financial literacy in the family, if you go to the moneymatters.ca website.
Now, I think one of the things that's interesting about your organization is you think about life literacy in a very holistic way. Tell us about some of the other areas in which you're trying to improve knowledge and behavior for people.
Yeah, so we really think of literacy and lifelong learning as one big part, and it's about moving people forward and building confidence. So we work in programs such as workplace literacy, so things about how to improve your time management or how to talk to other people in the workplace. We also talk about core literacy, so reading, writing, numeracy, that type of thing. And then we look at different what we call life capacities. So this could be things like health literacy, so learning how to be an advocate for yourself. At the doctors or pharmacist, or even things like how to vote, where to vote, and how to engage in voting at the federal level.
So people, you know, go to abcskillshub.ca, they choose one of the courses. How long do they take to do? Are there tests? Are there videos? What's the pedagogy?
Yeah, we don't have videos or tests. And the reason we want to keep it as straightforward as possible is we want to make sure that if you don't have super fast download, like if you're working in a rural or northern community and your internet speed may not be great, then you can still go through the course. And really what it is about is kind of getting people to go through it in the time that they need. The average amount of time is about 2 hours per module, but really it's take as long as you need or do it as quickly as you want. There's always something you're going to learn.
You referenced TD's support. It's part of their READY commitment. One of the areas that can be complex is when nonprofits work with industry to develop material that both serves the greater good and is consistent with the corporate social responsibility of the sponsor. How has that dance gone for you?
It's gone exceptionally well. And it's a good question. I mean, it's something that a lot of us think about is, you know, is there a conflict of interest there? And there really isn't. And to give you an example, we've had over 1,200 TD volunteers over the last few years volunteer in the community. And these are communities, they're not high income communities. These are not the, you know, the golden ticket clients that banks are looking for. These are the people that are just starting out their banking, thinking about banking in a healthy way. And these amazing volunteers come in, they donate their time, hours and hours of time, to be advocates for the learners. And they come in there, they are no longer advocates for the bank, they are advocates for their learners. And it's a beautiful thing to see.
I believe it. And I agree. I think there is a way to reconcile those two interests, which in some ways can compete and in some ways are complementary, right? Your unit on borrowing money talks about how credit works and ways to borrow. What's the big takeaway there? And I guess in the population that you work so closely with, it would seem to me that there is a higher risk of some of the predatory lending or some of the things that people in higher income brackets might not be prone to utilize because they can get a line of credit or a home equity line of credit on their house or whatever.
Absolutely. And predatory lending, we talk about that quite a bit and compare it to what other options are out there to make sure people know that there are other options. Now, but it's not just what we normally consider the predatory lenders. It's also things like if you ask many of our learners, what's the punishment for not paying your phone bill? Let's say because there's a charge on there that you disagree with, so you decide not to pay your phone bill. Most of them will respond that it's they lose that phone number. They lose that the service with that carrier. Whereas those of us who have more experience in financial literacy understand that it's the hit on your credit score that really has the long-term effect of not paying that bill.
Very interesting stuff. Our listeners can find the Skills Hub where?
abcskillshub.ca.
Okay, lots of great stuff on financial literacy and more as well. Mac, thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Bruce. Really appreciate the time.
Mac Rogers is the Executive Director of ABC Life Literacy Canada. Well, that is our show for today. Thank you so much for joining us. Here's an easy way to stay up to date on all things Moolala, and that is to subscribe to our newsletter. It comes once a month. You can put your email in at moolala.ca, and you'll get a newsletter once a month that goes through a bunch of stuff that I do in lots of places. This show on SiriusXM, my column on CBC Radio, my segments on BNN Bloomberg and CityLine, all that kind of stuff. If you have comments or questions, feel free to send them to ask@moolala.ca or on social media. I am at Bruce Selry on Twitter, Bruce Selry Moolala on Facebook. Thank you so much for joining us, and have a great day.